And this is KNX In Depth, an hour each day when we dig deeper, ask more questions, tell you how the major stories of the day impact you. I'm Mike Simpson along with Charles Feldman.
Oh, those scooters, you know the ones. In many cities throughout Southern California, you see them in traffic and on the sidewalks. Beverly Hills has imposed a six-month ban. Santa Monica has confiscated some. So we will go in depth on whether the scooters are the motorized wave of the future or a menace to pedestrians and car drivers alike. Also, a very personal talk with LAPD Chief Michael Moore following this past weekend's incident at the Trader Joe's in Silver Lake, an incident that led to the death of a young store manager by a police bullet.
Also on today's show, former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer joins us. We go in depth with him about the Trump White House behind the scenes. And how do you know when the food in the fridge has really gone bad? We give it the old smell test. But first, those scooters, which have become among the most polarizing issues out there. Everybody talks about it. Everybody's got an opinion. John DiMicco is mayor pro tem of the city of West Hollywood. He was the lone dissenting vote in West Hollywood's move to ban the scooters. So, John, did it feel lonely up there?
Well, it certainly wasn't my favorite moment serving on the city council, that's for sure.
Let me ask you something, though, and tell me if this is a correct quote. You're quoted as saying that it breaks my heart to see that our city is turning our back on young people in this way. But we had somebody on just the other week from Cedars-Sinai ER talking about broken bones. So what's more important, breaking hearts or breaking bones?
Well, come on, it's neither. I mean, the West Side is aging, at least the part of the West Side that includes West Hollywood. And my colleagues are sort of turning themselves into the get off my lawn and turn down that music crowd. In my mind, we need to invite young people to engage with what's happening in West Hollywood. And we want them to use them smartly. I mean,
well, but that's,
they
but that's
happen
the
to
issue.
Mention
yes.
how many bicycle accidents there
well,
were.
Well, let's not go to bicycles. Accidents. We're not going to talk about bicycles. We're going to talk about scooters and scooters only.
Right.
So let's talk about the scooters. As you know, in the state of California, you're not allowed to ride them without helmets. You're not allowed to ride them without a driver's license. You're not allowed to ride them on sidewalks, and you're not allowed to ride them on the streets. So I walk through West Hollywood and other communities, but let's zero in on West Hollywood. I see every single day more people than not riding on sidewalks, riding without helmets. And I'm guessing some of the ones I'm seeing are not even 18. So what do we do about that? What do you do about that?
Well, that's exactly right. And what we decided to do was to turn them into criminals and take a business and make the users of that business people who can now get tickets or don't have any sort of guidance about how to use it properly. I was contending that we should engage with these businesses and we should regulate them. We should prepare some kind of public service announcement that says, here's where you can ride them. Here's how you can use them safely. But at this point, all we've said is, if you get caught on one of these in our city, we might give you a ticket. If you leave it somewhere, we don't want you to leave it. We might confiscate it, but it could take 4 hours or overnight before our own city compliance gets it together to pick it up off the street and charge $40 to the vendor. So to me, it just seems like we were trying to ignore our way out of this problem. And in my mind, like all good sort of public policy, if we think about it smartly and we work with the businesses and we regulate them to make sure that people don't hurt themselves while using it, the city gets to maintain its level of calm, then that's a smart way to move forward.
Do some of your
right
colleagues,
now, we're not really anywhere.
Do they have a point, though, in when they say, look, that company or these companies should have come to us first and asked us, let's plan together instead of just having these things pop up all over the place and being left all over the sidewalks?
Well, that happened for 2 days, I think, in April. So the sort of come to us first because our feelings will be hurt if you don't, it's kind of a lame excuse. I mean, these are businesses. These are people who are engaged in the business of doing their business.
Well, but hold on. Wait. Hold on a second. Wait a minute. If you want to open a store in West Hollywood, you have to get certain licenses depending what you want. You register at the city, and you know that. So to say that okay, it was only a couple of days and they left their scooters there, in effect, so what? Would you say that if somebody opened a ice cream store or a supermarket without being properly licensed in the city of West Hollywood? Would you say that?
I didn't say so. At that point, they were not violating the law. The law didn't exist. It didn't say you couldn't leave your scooters on our street for use. But now we have a law that says that. But are we enforcing it? Not really.
So what happens? I mean, what's next for West Hollywood and the scooters? What do you say to your colleagues?
What I say to my colleagues is that at some point we need to pull up our big boy pants and address this problem the way other cities have and allow those scooters to be part of the set of things that people engage with to get around the city. I know you don't want me to say bicycles, but people use bicycles, they use cars, they use our free trams, they use the Metro bus system, and God willing, one day they'll be using the Metro fixed rail system if it ever comes through West Hollywood. But I think to just say, we don't want them, they're illegal, and then every time one rides through town, pretend it doesn't exist, that's no way to
run a government. Well, let me ask you, what indications do you have that these companies, Bird, Lime in particular, are really eager to be regulated? And while I say that, I want to point out that we've made repeated attempts to have representatives of these companies, Bird, Lime, Spin, on the program. They all either declined to participate or didn't answer our requests. What's the evidence that you have that they are open to being regulated?
They've all met with me. As a council member, I've met with them in my offices at City Hall. They've come forward. They worked with the city staff to put a pilot project potentially in place. They worked on this. They worked with the staff on the staff reports. They were willing to limit the numbers, the locations of them, to help with putting together a PSA. So they may not be responding to you as a news organization, but they're certainly responding to me as a member of a local government.
All right, that's John DiMicco, Mayor Pro Tem of the City of West Hollywood. The lone dissenting vote in West Hollywood's move to ban the scooters.
When KNX In Depth continues, Los Angeles Police Chief Michael Moore joins us for a personal discussion and his thoughts in the aftermath of the shooting at Trader Joe's. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman. A reminder that coming up after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, we will talk with former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
Right now, though, Los Angeles Police Chief Michael Moore. We're talking about the aftermath of the shootout at the Trader Joe's, the fatal shooting of the manager. Chief, we understand you went to the memorial outside that store the other night. What was going through your mind?
Well, I went there. It was just something that I wanted to spend some time with alone and on behalf of my family. Actually, my daughter and wife are out of town, and we put a card together and just wanted to drop it off. And it's obviously a lot of us are grieving through this, and it was an opportunity to show my respect to a family that and to a community that has suffered this loss and just to be a part of that.
Let me ask you this. I mean, you have been, of course, with the LAPD for a very long time. You've been all your adult life, you've been in the police department. At what point after this incident occurred on Saturday, did the thought start going through your head, just knowing what you knew, the possibility, maybe even the likelihood, that the young store manager was killed by a police bullet and not a bullet from the suspect? At what point did that start going off in your head, that alarm?
Well, the night of the event. This was a confrontation that was extremely violent, that officers were faced with a gunman that was firing at them from a location that had people about, and the potential for a stray bullet or their round to strike someone was there, and that's what our officers must wrestle with every day. And at the same time, the violence that this individual had demonstrated his willingness to exact on a family member and officers themselves, I also knew that it was very possible that he attacked her and shot her as part of his rampage. So, but I recognized, we all recognized that it's one of aspects of trying to understand this event was what was the source of that, of her injury.
You said it was devastating for these officers when they found out, when the word definitely came down that it was one of their bullets. What do you say to them in that situation?
Well, it was devastating and more than that. It was devastating in the sense of that one of their rounds struck and killed her. But it was also devastating because I believe, and I know it was devastating to us that night with the men and women that were there, fire and police, as well as the mayor and Councilman Rue, is that we had lost this store manager is, that we weren't able to stop him, this suspect who was bent on this rampage, that we weren't able to stop him from causing further harm. And that's what, you know, the aspect of this is it has layers to it, that this wasn't just the loss of an individual at our hands, but that our actions couldn't stop him prior to him exacting further violence.
I want to go back a minute or two to when you are with Mike and I the last time on the show, when you just became a police chief. We were talking, as you probably will recall, a bit about your own background. And you know, remember we had talked about how statistics show most police officers never have to fire a gun in their career. You had to very early on, once on the department, once when you were doing, I think it was security work outside of the department. From that personal experience, what are you able to tell the officer or officers involved in the shooting incident at Trader Joe's from just a state of mind point of view? And let's forget all the legalities and what you maybe you can or can't tell them until an investigation is complete. Just in terms of psychological support, drawing from your own background, what can you share with them? What did you share with them?
Well, first of all, I learned a long time ago in leadership that you don't make it about yourself. And so in my instances and my conversation with officers in the department, it's not about Mike Moore or my experience. It's about them and how do I help and support them and what questions do they have and how are they feeling? And then I do reflect on my background and my experience and as well as what I've learned from leaders throughout this organization throughout the years. And then I'll color my remarks, and those remarks are informed by those experiences. But it's not an arm around the shoulder of, you know, hey kid, I was involved in this. I know what it's like. I think that style of leadership went out a long time ago.
Coming up when KNX In-Depth continues, more with LA Police Chief Michael Moore. What kind of tactical observations were made after the shooting at Trader Joe's? You're listening to KNX In-Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman. A reminder that after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking with former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. I'm sure he's got some stories to tell. Right now, though, we continue our discussion with LA Police Chief Michael Moore. In the aftermath of the shooting at Trader Joe's, have we learned anything in terms of changing any tactics or procedures?
Well, we look at every scenario as an opportunity to understand and learn how does the equipment that we provide, how does our instruction, how is it implemented in this instance? How did it roll out? What were the desired outcomes and what consequences did we experience that we didn't want to? And in this instance, as, you know, we'll look at it with a level of forensic acuity to try to pull it apart, examine it. As I said yesterday, we know the public and others will watch these videos and the other information we put out with over and over again and keep coming back to similar questions. And the department will do the same. And you know, when all the information is in, I'll be in a much better position to be informed as to what tactics, what training, what equipment, what other options or strategies should we be exploring?
Chief, is there any doubt in your mind, with the notable and unfortunate exception of the store manager who was killed, is there any doubt in your mind that the police that day, Saturday, saved many lives?
No, none at all. In fact, I visited the SWAT team in the immediate aftermath of this and thanked them for what they were able to achieve, because as I told them, and I'll say to you, the certainty of this outcome was not there. We did not control and could not control everything that this man was capable of doing. And we didn't know, we knew he was armed. We knew he had used violence on others, including his own family. And we knew he was threatening to kill hostages inside unless we met his demands. And I was so proud of those men and women because they, with the assistance of their psychologists from our behavioral Science Services Division, as well as trained crisis negotiators, were able to complement a security around that location and not just contain it, but persuade and cajole and gain this suspect's compliance without causing further violence. And without question, had they not done those, taken those steps and exercised their training and their skill set, this could have been much worse. That handgun that was recovered from this gunman was still loaded. And so I'm complimentary, but at the same time, I must say that this is very early on with what I know. We're going to go back through this incident with a fine-tooth comb and look and see, are there other things, though, that we could have done better or should have done differently? And that's why this department is seen as a world leader, is because while we recognize that we were fortunate that there wasn't a future, there wasn't loss of life, including the loss of a police officer's life in this ordeal, we've got to go back at it and say, how can we do better? And how do we perform at a higher level? That's what makes a world-class organization, and that's what makes the Los Angeles Police Department, I believe, a leader in policing.
When KNX In-Depth continues, we will talk with Sean Spicer. You're listening to KNX In-Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
And we turn now to Sean Spicer, the first official spokesperson for the Trump administration. He has a new book out, and he joins us here on In-Depth.
And the book is called, by the way, The Briefing, Politics, the Press, and the President, in which he describes his former boss, that would be President Trump, as a, quote, unicorn riding a unicorn across a rainbow. Well, Mr. Spicer, that's a rather interesting description of Mr. Trump, a unicorn riding a unicorn across a rainbow. Can you explain that one?
I can. So what I was answering my own question on this. When I'm traveling the country, a lot of times during events and speeches, people will say, are we going to see another candidate like Trump? Are candidates now going to be in the mold of Trump? And my point is to say, you know, look, this is a guy it is truly unique in every way, in his candidacy, in his campaign. And anyone who thinks that somehow this is, you know, going to be the new norm is I think misreading what he was like as a candidate in the campaign that he ran.
Unique, one word, but enough to give a lot of people a headache, I think, is another, because we wake up every day to all these alerts on our phones, and it just seems like we are in this cycle that never, ever ends.
I get it. And I think that, you know, as someone who, you know, spent 6 years at the RNC and then went through the primary debate process and the convention and coming out of there, the general election, those debates and then the transition, I mean, it's exhausting.
I'm sure you get tired of questions about the veracity of the president and also your own truthfulness in trying to portray what the president was thinking or saying when you were the person there at the lectern. But we'll plunge ahead anyway with those questions. And I guess it's that a lot of people, and even some Trump supporters, as you know, will say, look, you know, we support his policies, we support this and that, but even some hardcore Republicans are troubled by Mr. Trump's unique ability to often not tell exactly the truth. And when you were representing him, I get it, it was your job, but weren't you bothered from time to time having to say things that you knew really weren't true?
Well, I think in many cases, you know, I would ask, you know, what does the president believe or what does he think on this? And I would answer the question. My job, you know, as I've noted before, wasn't to go out and say, you know, I know he believes this, but therefore, I disagree with it. That's not the job. And I've heard this question over and over again. My point is that you're not out there to be an interpreter for him. You're out there to say, this is what you believe, or, you know, it's different. I mean, I think what people got upset about is saying, how could he possibly believe that? Well, that's a question for him.
I totally get what you're saying, that you're not there to interpret, you're there to be a spokesperson and to say what the president said. So, but that raises a sort of interesting question, though, Sean. Were there times when you stood there and you did your job what you were getting paid to do. You said accurately what the president was saying, but were there times when you knew that what you were saying, what the president was saying, just wasn't true?
I mean, look, I have worked for countless members of Congress, or not countless, but a number of members of Congress and candidates, where you would have conversations with them, ask them what they believe or why they support something. It's how you approach the job. My view was, you go in, you share the counsel and advice that you have with them on the tactics, strategy, and messages that are likely to come up or be addressed or that you're rolling out. But ultimately, it is them who tell you what they want to say and what they believe.
But that was a very good, my hat's off to you, that was a very good deflection of the question. But that wasn't actually the question. The question is, were there times when you were saying things at the White House that you were saying what the president said and you were doing your job? No one's going to take that away from you. You were doing what you were getting paid to do. But were there times when you knew, not you guessed or you thought, but you just knew it was not true?
I, at the top of my head, I cannot think of one, no.
The crowd size?
The crowd size, look, I write that extensively in the book, guys. I write, that's on me. I screwed that day up. I would love a do-over. But again, this gets back down to you. Everyone saying, "Well, the president said that did not like the idea that after constantly undermining the credibility and the validity of his victory, and that the focus had been on whether or not there was a bust of Martin Luther King falsely removed from the Oval Office, but to continue to see a bunch of stories that were not focused on the agenda, were not focused on getting things done. They wanted to push back. But I write extensively in the book about this that." I would love a do-over on that day, and it's something that I wish that I could have gone out and done much, much differently.
When the president has said, and continues to say, that, and sometimes he has said some members of the press, sometimes he just blanket says the press, the media, enemies of the people. Do you believe that?
Here's my angle on that. I believe that you need a free and robust press in any democracy, especially ours, as the beacon of the free world. I believe that there are very good reporters. I name them in the book. If you've been able to peruse it a little, I literally go through and say there are some of these reporters that you may not, you'd be probably a little surprised, that I think are tenacious, tough, but professional. They write tough stories that I a lot of times didn't agree with, but I felt like they were top-notch professionals. But I do think that there are a lot of reporters that either, through their actions and antics are unprofessional and or through their perpetuating false narratives or false stories, I think are not good. But I think that I don't believe that you paint everybody with the same broad brush because I don't think you would want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
You feel like you couldn't get a fair shake from some of them no matter what you did?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, there's no question about it. And I that some of these reporters, there is no question about it. There was another study that came out today that showed that 92% of the coverage of the president is negative. 92%. That's consistent with some of the other studies that have come out, whether it's Pew Research or Harvard, that talk about the vast majority of coverage is negative. And you look at the amount of stuff that, frankly, is getting done in terms of where the economy is and some of the other things, and you go, this doesn't jive. With what's getting done to say, I mean, I get it if it's 60-40 or something, but the idea that it's 92%, at some point you got to say to yourself, is he being covered objectively? And I think in large cases, not. The answer is no.
Coming up next, Sean Spicer sticks with us for more behind the scenes at the White House when KNX In Depth continues. You're listening to KNX In Depth. I'm Charles Feldman, along with Mike Simpson. Sean Spicer, who served as President Trump's White House press secretary for 8 months last year, stays with us to talk about his book, The Briefing. The relationship that you have maybe now with President Trump, do you consider him, did you ever consider him a friend? Or was he just an employer?
I think it's a weird thing I believe that I was an employee. He was kind enough the other day to tweet out that we were friends. I think that's unbelievably kind. And But you know, I don't know. I'm this kid from Rhode Island that got the honor of being White House press secretary. I've never really thought of myself as friends with the president of the United States. I was very generous of him to say that, and I would love to be a, you know, I always could use more friends.
Do you still give him, or do you give him any advice at all now?
When he asks for it, you know, if I see him and he asks me, which I do from time to time still, if he asks, I share it with him.
Is it hard to be friends with a president, or in another way, is it hard to stand up to a president? Is there someone in that White House where if he's got something wrong, says to him, we got to reverse course on this? Because it seems like it doesn't happen all that much.
That's probably when people ask me all the time, what's the one thing that people get wrong? And that is the number one thing. The idea that people don't stand up to him or that he doesn't listen to people or doesn't want a robust debate is 100% false. He may not agree with you. Don't get me wrong. Or he may choose to come to a different outcome based on his view of a matter. But I think that is such a false narrative that gets perpetuated out there. There's a lot of times when if you think about just trade alone, think about in the White House right now, you've got Peter Navarro and Wilbur Ross, and then you had, you know, in some cases, Gary Cohn. They were on opposite sides of issues. So somebody's going to win and someone's going to lose. And no matter what happens, someone say, oh, well, the president didn't listen. Well, clearly he was listening to one side of it, right? It's just a lot of times the media and people, whatever, when they don't get the outcome that they think is the right one or perceived to be the right one, then the assumption is, well, he clearly didn't listen.
You were actually scheduled, I think, was it today, to do a book signing in Massachusetts somewhere, and they canceled it because of the what political climate, which I think is sort of an absurd thing to do, frankly. But what do you make of the political climate that we are in now, the polarization? And I think that perhaps what happened to you with your own book signing is a reflection of this polarization. And to some degree, don't you have to blame the man in the Oval Office for that?
Well, first of all, so yeah, the event was not supposed to be on Saturday. But here's how ridiculous this is. I have events scheduled out in California. I've got a sold out event in San Francisco, not exactly the hotbed of conservative activity. I've got an event tonight in Midtown Manhattan. I've got another event tomorrow in Washington, D.C., three in over the weekend in Rhode Island. The idea that the left shut down or tried to shut down this event in Massachusetts, I think it's actually should be something that's sad to everybody. The idea that you can't have an event to discuss a book on either side, and I would say that no matter who wrote it. The idea that the left puts that kind of pressure on a store to say we don't think that should be there. I mean, their job is to sell books. You don't have to buy it if you don't like it. You don't have to come if you don't want to. But the idea that we have gotten to the point where the discourse that you can't have a respectful and civil discourse, I think is a very, very sad state for our country and our society.
Do you expect many Democrats to read this book? I mean, why would an anti-Trump Democrat want to pick this thing up?
I don't know. Maybe because they want to have an interest in knowing what happened during. It's not just about the White House. It's about the election. I've read Plus book. I read a lot of books on the left. I think if you're a good conservative, you understand that's interested in politics, you would definitely want to know what the Obama campaign did, what the Hillary Clinton campaign did, so that you become a better political expert. Or if that's your interest, if you're interested in just understanding what actually happened during the campaign or some of the things that were going on behind the scenes. But it's the same reason that everyone, you know, that I will sit down and spar with liberal friends every once in a while, because I think it makes you a smarter and better person. To the extent that people want to understand and get a little behind the scenes look at what happened, whether it was the convention, the campaign trail, or even, you know, the transition or White House, I think it gives you an insight that necessarily you don't get from a lot of other sources. It's a perspective that I think you're not going to get. I'm probably the first person I'm pretty sure I am the first person that was there through all of those seminal moments that can actually give you a firsthand look of what was going on.
The Saturday Night Live characterizations of you, now I have to admit, I found them incredibly funny, but I'm not you. Did you find them funny, or did you cringe? Did it hurt your feelings? I'm curious what went through your mind, because some of them were pretty brutal.
Yeah, and I obviously, you know, walked through that all in the book. The first one I thought was pretty funny and, frankly, well-deserved. I kind of stepped in it, and I think that Melissa McCarthy did a good job of poking me, and I got a kick out of it. I think the other one's got a little personal and mean. And that's where I think you lose the sense of comedy. I looked at it and I'm like, okay, I'm not sure I think that's funny. But, you know, each their own.
Do you miss it, or are there days where you see Sarah up there and you go, oof, I'm glad that's not me?
Oh, I just to be clear, I loved being able to do this. I think it truly is an honor. There are 30 people that have held that job in our nation's history, and it's surreal to think that I was one of them, but I don't miss it for one day. Like I tell the president, I'm honored to have served in the White House, but I am glad that it's Sarah, not me now.
I was going to say, suppose, and stranger things have happened, as you know, in Washington, suppose one day your cell phone rings, hypothetically. You're walking down the street in Manhattan. Cell phone rings. It's the president of the United States on the other line, and he says, Sean, it's me, Donald. Come back. I want you to do the old job again. What would you say?
I would say, Mr. President, thank you for the call. But I think I would be glad to help you search for candidates. I'm not sure.
You're breaking up. I'm going through a tunnel. I can't hear you.
But look, I part of the reason I wrote the book is to explain to people a lot of like what you're asking, which is what was going on behind the scenes. How did you feel? What was the impact on your family? Those are the kind of things that, frankly, once you read it and you understand that, I think you go, okay, I get it.
All right, Sean Spicer, thanks for the time. He's got that book, The Briefing, Politics Press, and The President.
Interesting guy. When KNX In-Depth continues, some of the stories you may have missed, but we did not. And you're listening to KNX In-Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman. So, you know, we have all this hot weather, and when the weather turns hot, people often wonder about food, right? About whether or not something's going to stay fresh. And there's an awful lot of confusion about what all those labels mean. You know, what do you got? You got the best if used by, sell by, use by.
Yeah, and it turns out they don't have much to do with how safe the food is.
Not at all, yeah.
It's not like a government safety thing. It's just phrases they use. So the best if used by, that's, best quality or flavor. So maybe the salsa isn't as tasty as it once was. It's not about safety.
No.
The sell by is just getting it out of the store because they tell you to take it off the shelf if you don't get to the sell by in time. But then you're on your own once you get it home.
Well, the rule that I follow, by the way, is whatever the date is, I get rid of it a year before. That way it's perfectly safe.
He has saltine crackers and nothing else in the cabinets. So just use the use by,
well,
because that one says use by.
Yeah, and by the way, a lot of this advice, courtesy of Consumer Reports, and they point out in an interesting piece about, you can freeze stuff, you can save things like fruit for a fairly long period of time. So a lot of those dates, because frankly, the people that make these products want you to get rid of them and buy new ones, but you don't really have to in many cases.
Just smell it. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Mike Simpson. Thanks for joining us here on In-Depth. We're going to have more tomorrow at 1 p.m. CBS News coming up next.